Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Perkins Platform. Welcome. This is a solutions-oriented podcast and live radio show. Each broadcast, we dedicate just about 30 minutes to explore contemporary issues and solutions in leadership, and this is your host, Brian Perkins. I can't begin to tell you how excited I am about this week. For the first time, we're having a four-part series connected in a lot of ways. So the first part of why I'm excited is that this four-part series should be really informative and just give all of you listening in something to think about. As you know, these podcasts and live shows are really more conversations that you are listening in on, and today will be no different. And the second part of why I'm really excited is that today is a introduction of something we hope to do going into the future. And I want to introduce all of you to my daughter, Erin, who is going to hopefully become a regular contributor to the podcast going forward in what we're calling a kind of book club, our father-daughter book club. Erin is currently a graduating senior at The Ohio State University, majored in sociology, and proud to say she'll be attending the University of Utah Law School in September. Erin is interested in serving historically disadvantaged and disenfranchised communities, and so I'm excited to do this podcast with her. So welcome to the podcast, Erin.
Hello, I'm excited to be here.
Good, good. And, you know, before any of you think that I am the one that put her up to this, quite honestly, she was reading and wanted to read more of Baldwin's work, and we were talking about it, and I asked her, you know, kind of what made her interested in it, and shortly after we talked, she said, you know, we ought to do a podcast of us talking about it. We've had some great conversations about a lot of different things. And so I took her up on it, and here she is. And so hopefully some of you have read along once you found out that we were going to do this broadcast focused in on The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin. And you read the text, or some of you may have read it in college or otherwise for easy reading, and have decided to also join in on the conversation. We will break in time. Those of you who want to call in, there is a place for you to call in, 657-31481. Again, 657-383-1481. And we'll take calls as we get a chance to break. But also, as a part of this, I'm going to talk a little bit about it later, too. But there are, after tonight, at 8 p.m. Eastern time all week, Monday through Thursday, we're going to do other parts in the series. Tomorrow, I have a gentleman, William F. Spivey, who is a author and writer and contributor to Medium.com, who will be here to discuss in part, kind of part two, to talking about not only James Baldwin, but a number of people who have written. And we're just going to go back to what I'm calling a time capsule around 1960. And what William Spivey and I are going to talk about is, has anything changed? That's tomorrow night, 8 p.m. Eastern. And then on Wednesday, a panel of black men who have black boys, and it, the title of that show is Why the Conversation Black Men Have with Their Boys is Necessary. And we're talking about The Talk, and the talk about assuming their place in society and making the right choices, so forth. And so I initially, it was going to be a three-part series, and I told Aaron about it. I was excited, and Aaron challenged me to reconsider the three-part series, and now I've made it a four-part series and invited a panel of black women who are mothers with daughters and who have also had similar discussions about being black in America. So we'll talk a little bit about those later. I will let you know that I'm broadcasting live from New Orleans, and we're in the middle of a rainstorm. And if you know New Orleans, you know that at any time the lights can go out. And so have a backup plan. We have battery-powered internet and computer system ready in case it goes out. So Aaron is all prepared to kind of carry the load until I can log back in if that happens, but we're definitely prepared for it. So enough of me just kind of going on and on about what's coming and what's going on. I want to say this as a start, because Aaron, I really would like to know a little bit more about what kind of motivated you to, you know, explore James Baldwin a little bit. And I have to say, a lot of people who know me know that I grew up in a small town in northern Alabama, northwest corner of Alabama, and fairly traditional high school. And we read the classics. We really didn't read any, for lack of better words, contemporary authors. Of course, we read people like Robert Frost, and even going back to others like Shakespeare and Chaucer and the like. But my whole high school experience, we did not have people like Toni Morrison or James Baldwin. And so it was not until I went to college that I even knew who these people were. And I went to college at a historically black college. And so, of course, those were part of our curriculum. But in high school, never I'd heard of James Baldwin, but didn't know about his work. And so since that time, for me, I've been fascinated not only with his work, written work, but his advocacy and some of the videos. If you haven't had a chance to see them, I strongly advise you to go on YouTube and take a look at some of his debates and treatise on racial politics in America during that time. Brilliant, brilliant man. So I've been fascinated by his writing and otherwise. But for me, it was just really after hearing about him and really wonder and say, I didn't get it in high school. So what is all the fuss about James Baldwin? And so it was certainly long, even after college, that I picked up books and tried to read some of his work. So why don't we start there before we even get into the text, Aaron? Tell me a little bit about why did you get interested in him and what made you decide to pick up Baldwin?
It was the random scroll through YouTube, and I landed upon James Baldwin and Nikki Giovanni's interview. It was a two-part series. It's about 2 hours long. But I was really fascinated by how he talked and what he had to say, and their conversation was just really amazing to me, so I wanted to read up on his work. So I did some Google searches, and I found a couple. I also have Nobody Knows My Name and then Notes of a Native Son, which I look forward to reading. But it was initially the YouTube video with Nikki Giovanni.
Right, right. Well, I haven't seen. I've seen it kind of in the margin, so I haven't looked at that one. The one that I saw, and I think I may have recommended it to you, was his debate with William Buckley at Oxford, I think it was. And I think that's probably what just left me in awe of his intellect, his ability to communicate and articulate his ideas, so profound in his use of kind of argument. And I was just really impressed with how he dissected what was going on. You know, sometimes when it's personal, we get emotional and are not always the best communicators. But this was something deeply and was deeply, deeply personal for him, and he did such a great job. So the one that you saw with Nikki Giovanni, what was the topic? What was he talking about?
So first, they start off talking about black writers and two different generations. So Nikki asks if like James depends on her generation of black writers, and he's like, of course I do. And then they get into topics about the black community, which are still very relevant today, which is why I related to it so much. I think often you can learn a lot from other people's conversations. You can learn a lot about yourself and the world in which you live. So they talked about black relationships. They discussed just a myriad of topics surrounding the black community.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier, you said something about that they were relevant today. What was it? Just one of the things that you thought was that they talked about that was relevant to what's going on right now.
I think the condition of the black male. So I'm in my early 20s and figuring out navigating romantic relationships or platonic relationships. And they talk one that really stood out to me was when Nikki Giovanni said, "You can pretend all day for the world, but because I love you most, I get the worst of you," referring to the black man, how he's constantly tested in the public, at work, and he just is constantly berated, and then gets home and then expels that on his partner, and she's saying, "I love you, so I get the worst of you, but why can't you pretend for me?" And so that really struck me. Like, what effort are you willing to put into your relationship? When you come home, you often want to take off that mask. You want to release your feelings, but that often isn't the best thing for your partner.
Sure.
A lot of negative stuff can come from that. So that was one that stood out to me.
Yeah. No, fascinating. So, you know, just kind of moving to the text that we agreed to talk about, and I think I'm really excited because of, you know, the future books also to read, the ones that you just mentioned very early on. So for those of you who may not have read The Fire Next Time, it's divided into two distinct sections. The first one is pretty well known and discussed. Is a letter. It's entitled "My Dungeon Shook," letter to my nephew on the 100th anniversary of the emancipation. And it's a fairly, I guess if you could say it's not a long, long letter, but it's a substantial letter to his nephew. And then the second section is down at the cross, letter from a region in my mind. And I'm not sure if it was free flow. I don't know if it's available out there, that he may have ever commented on, if it was just kind of a free flow type dump, but it is incredibly powerful as well. So let's start with, and I'm, you know, I told Aaron at the beginning of this, let's just go as far as we can. You know, we've allocated an hour to talk about this, and I know we could probably go all day on just the first letter. So I have highlighted and written in the margins. I don't know what you did, but I had quite a few things. But Vic, like, I honestly, after the first page starts at the very bottom of the page, and then the next page I already started highlighting. What I thought was interesting, the first thing that jumped for me was that he started talking about who this nephew might be like in his family. And he mentioned the grandfather and said, you know, the grandfather was kind of defeated long before he died because he had believed what the white man had said about him. But he goes on to talk about kind of the status very quickly in the letter. He jumps right to what might be perceived as a negative tone. And he says, I tell you this because I love you, and please don't you ever forget it. It's that the way this started with talking about his grandfather and not knowing if he was going to be like his grandfather or not, but that to stop and to emphasize that, almost like prepare yourself, but I want you to know that I love you and I don't ever forget it. Like on these pages, what you're about to read, what anything you might see, that this is what motivates me to say these things. Did that strike you the way it struck me, that he just kind of inserted that as he, like, in the middle of talking about what was?
Right. It's kind of like the trigger warning of the note to his nephew. It's the introduction to I'm about to relay some disheartening information about living as a black man, but it's necessary. Like the police talks that black families have with their children is distressing and disappointing to have to do, but I do it because I love you.
Right.
And I want you to be well equipped to survive in a white America.
Yeah. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
It actually reminds me of something you have told me. It kind of gives me the same feeling. I remember you told me before I went to college, you were like, be careful because you don't get as many opportunities as these white people do. So, like, if you mess up or, you know, something just happens, you won't get that benefit of the doubt. And that is reminiscent of that quote that you just said.
And, you know, for me, I think probably the reason that resonated with me is because as a parent, having to relay, and in this case, he was the uncle, and I think he probably felt that he was the one that was best equipped to share this or to articulate this for his nephew, is that in a lot of ways, it's a painful conversation to have. And I know there are those of, you know, there are people who are listening who will probably listen to next week, I mean, on Wednesday, the conversation with the panel, and on Thursday, but it's a painful conversation. And throughout, it's not easy, because so much of what generally you want to be able to say is, if you work hard and you do everything you're supposed to do, that you'll get everything you deserve. And I think
it
about...
is not the case.
Not the case. And yeah. I know people will say, well, that's what everybody... Well, yeah, I believe that it is the case where everyone, I think, is more pronounced in this country for Black people. And I'm intentionally saying Black people have a very different experience with the meritocracy, or the promise of meritocracy. And so my father said to me almost kind of just that thing, was that work really hard. Not going to get everything you deserve, though, but work hard to accomplish as much as you can to fulfill your purpose in life, but never the promise. And you may remember, I didn't promise any of you girls that you would get everything you deserved, but that there would be a lot more opportunities if you do work hard.
Yeah. And that's interesting, because you said the meritocracy, but it reminds me of the interview with Nikki Giovanni, that he said that it's often the case that Black people have to be excellent where white people can be mediocre. Mm-hmm. So it's this constant bar that we have to reach, this unattainable bar that even if you reach it, there's still systematic things that are restricting you, or people who can limit your opportunities. And so it's this constant strive to be excellent where other people don't have to be.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I want to pivot a little bit. Right after that, there's a section that he goes into that really also struck me, where he said that, and he refers to on more than one occasion, and it's interesting because he referred to fellow Americans in his debate with William Buckley. He referred to them as his countrymen. And he did the same thing here. He talked about his countrymen, and he says that they are destroying hundreds of thousands of lives and do not know it and do not want to know. So I used to think that there are not, while I don't believe there are widespread numbers of people who are plotting, but I wonder if he said that to bring attention to it. But to what extent do you think there are people who do not know that they're destroying hundreds of thousands of lives and do not want to know it? I used to believe that. I think I used to believe that there weren't people plotting to destroy. But I don't believe that anymore.
I don't think it's deliberate. I think it's when you fail to acknowledge your privilege and fail to speak up. He even says people find it very difficult to act on what they know. To act is to be committed, and to be committed is to be in danger. So you're endangering, he's basically referring to endangering your identity, you're endangering your sense of security. I don't know, because I'm not white, but I assume you kind of have an inkling of like, oh, it's kind of off. Something is, you know, I'm kind of doing better than people of color. But I'm not going to acknowledge it because that's just too much. It's just, you know, we had Obama. It's too much. It's over with. Or it's just failing to acknowledge the privilege and not doing anything, not speaking out about it. By not doing that, you're contributing to the problem, in my opinion.
So do you think it's a conscious not knowing? So what he's referring to here is that they do not know it and do not want to know, that it's a conscious, I'm not accepting it almost. Do you think that's what he's saying?
I mean, it has to be from media to, from cable media to social media, how could you ignore it? I think you'd actively have to ignore it. I think it's very in your face in America, especially this past summer. It was like week after week, you had another hashtag a name for Black Lives Matter, and it could be like maybe they aren't having, like, I just don't see a world where you don't come across it at least once, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you have to be consciously ignoring the fact.
Yeah. Well, you know, and even jumping ahead, because I'm going to come back to something else, but to your point about the meritocracy, though, he also says, and I quote, you were not expected to aspire to excellence. You are expected to make peace with mediocrity.
And that's what we battle with. It's outside expectations of who we are supposed to be, and then our own expectations that we set for ourselves, and then going out into the world and constantly battling that, going to a PWI, predominantly white institution. I see that a lot. I've seen that a lot across my 4 years of battling even professors' expectations of what I was capable of, or students' expectations. They expect you to, I don't know, I don't know what goes through their heads. Like, it's unfathomable to have a somebody who knows as much. Oh, and you're Black? It's just fighting the outside and keeping what you know yourself to be and keeping yourself to that standard, despite
right.
what they may think of you.
Right, right. But I guess my question is also, what happens, what about the battle on the inside? Not meaning inside the individual, but among Blacks about those expectations. Because you said something about also those expectations across kind of racial lines. But what about the mediocrity mindset that
I think. That Black people have.
Yeah, but that is also almost, that is a part of that people have been socialized that way. Large numbers of people.
Right.
And see, to me, that is, so the destroying hundreds of thousands of lives, to me, when he talked about that was, in fact, it's not just a physical destruction, but a psychological and social destruction as well. That mindset of mediocrity is also a part of the destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's
so my question
internalized.
Is, so how do you get it from, like, I mean, I should say not how do you get it out, but I mean, what do you think about the fact that it exists in the Black, dare I say, community, but the among blacks and the mindset of being mediocre?
I think it could be hard to try to divorce yourself from, especially when you have systematic elements in place, when you're not seeing your school funded like the white schools you travel to when you go and play sports. You're not seeing the development in your community. You when things around you are mediocre, all you can think is, okay, I am mediocre as well. You match your environment. That's not the case for everybody, but I think that contributes to maybe not being able to get out of that mindset. As for how to do it, I think that's what James Baldwin was trying to figure out throughout his life. Is he moved to Paris to become a writer and try to escape racial America, but found that you can't run away from something that's inside of you. You know, you don't run away from the problem. So that's why he came back. And I think he just really, I don't think he ever found the answer. I don't think we're going to find the answer anytime soon. I don't know.
Yeah.
How do you get rid of that mentality?
Yeah. And I do think that it will take quite some time I think a lot would have to shift in order to realize that. For those of you who just joined us, I'm speaking with my daughter, Erin. We are talking about The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin. It is a thought-provoking treatise on racial dynamics in America. In 1965, I think, was when he wrote this letter. And I know there were some other writings in 62, but this, you know, here we are some 60 years later, and the question is, you know, how much of this has changed? Erin said earlier in the broadcast that there was much about it that struck her in what he was saying back then relevant today through interviews and certainly now through the writing. So we're having this kind of text-based discussion, if you will, and there's another piece of the text I want to ask you about. What your thoughts are, and it's right after the comment about being hundreds of thousands of lives being destroyed. He says, but it is not permissible that the authors of devastation should also be innocent. It is the innocence which constitutes the crime. And so he goes on, and I just say kind of the first part of the next sentence was, now, my dear namesake, these innocent and well-meaning people have caused you to be born under conditions not very far removed. And he goes on, and so I wrote in the margins, innocent, ? And there's some other places that he describes them as innocent, and not sure he meant that. But I think what he is pointing out is that these people then and now so believed in their inability to be held responsible for even the privilege that they enjoy, the things that they took for granted, that in their minds that they were not responsible. And so they're innocent of that. And so, but what he describes as the innocence is the crime. I thought that was particularly poignant.
Why would you have to be accountable or feel responsible when you hold all the authority, when you created your own authority? Of course, you're not going to see anything wrong with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're not going to see anything wrong with it. I think the innocence is just the lack of acknowledgement that we were talking about earlier. It's the indifference. I think it also plays into the American mindset of individualism. As long as you are doing okay, your immediate circle and family is doing okay, there's no need to look outward, right? It's the facade of the American dream, and you don't need to think of other people because you are indoctrinated to believe that it's a fair and just system, you know. And if you're white, you're not really going to see anything in your view that is obstructing you. That, I mean, socioeconomic comes into play. Like, if you're poor, you might have more of an experience with this, but I lost my train of thought. But the innocent. So you're not going to, you don't need to be accountable because nobody is holding you accountable.
Sure.
We're trying to hold you accountable.
Right, right. And to me, that's part of what we're still struggling with is, I mean, because there are countless books that are being written about privilege now, and a lot of people are consultants about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and so forth. And so there's a lot of conversations. You say what? You say you hate that?
I think diversity and inclusion is just another way to separate us from being Americans. We're Black Americans. We're not Americans. I think it's another way to reach a quota. If you're so committed, if you are so assured that you want Black people, just make those opportunities happen then. You don't need a separate division, a Black division, mm-hmm. a Black this, a Black that. Mm-hmm. And just include, like, it's not, you don't, I think we tend to love categories and put people into little neat boxes, but I don't like diversity and inclusion. It feels just like another way of racism to me.
Sure. Well, but the thing is that, and I absolutely agree with you and hear you when you say that, you know, why not just be American, also recognizing kind of the historical context that's different, is that I think there are two really important caveats to that. One is that because we, you know, these categories and programs or what have you are necessary because they have been put in place almost to, you know, to try to even, because they don't do that, but to try to even the playing field more, because otherwise we would not be able to see any progress. You know, I think about, and I've told this story before to, I've taught classes in education, law, and policy, and I think about when President Kennedy first signed what was an executive order. It was actually Executive Order 10925, and it became known as affirmative action later. But basically, what people did was, They started to say things like affirmative action is reverse discrimination. And did not pay attention to the context of what was happening then and what continues to happen now. I am mm-hmm. all for the spirit of what happened then, because I mean, to your point, diversity, inclusion, why not just call us Americans? But it's because that wouldn't happen. And so President Kennedy said that, you know, it's we don't want to hear another kind of expert opinion on this. We don't need another blue ribbon panel employed. We don't need any other study done on this. It's been 100 years at that point, post-slavery, and the American black was still suffering from discrimination, and so the lack of inclusion, the lack of opportunity. And so on just this small level said, so you must, and that's what he's talking about, you must take affirmative action. You have to do this. You have to affirm this and place African-Americans, place blacks in positions. You must do this. And it was because people were not, and they still are not, if given a choice. So it had to come down as an executive order and then eventually law to force people to do it. And so that's the reason for me, policies and regulations regarding affirmative action or regarding equity are necessary. And so people turned it around. They said, well, affirmative action is reverse discrimination, and it's not fair. It was never intended to be fair. So it's like suddenly we got to talk about fairness when we're talking about these policies that have to be put in place to right wrongs, to right the fact that people are not doing what they should do, which is view individuals on the basis of what they can do versus just the color of their skin. You're going to say something?
Yeah, I understand that part. You know, we do want diversity in the workplace, but at the same time, it's, as a black community, it's how long are we going to accept the bare minimum from society? It's like, I think affirmative action has helped a lot of people, but I would prefer going into a workplace, like if affirmative action never happened, going into a workplace and seeing that they chose on their own merit to hire X amount of black people versus trying to meet a quota or trying to accommodate the law. I think that's where you have black people in situations where they're uncomfortable at work, or
sure,
they're the one black person in HR, or I think the law kind of is a veil for racism within the workspace, work field.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the double-edged sword. It's like it's necessary. Black people need these opportunities, but we need to see what these companies are really about outside of quotas, and that's where we need to put our energy and our dollar and things like that.
Well, now you going way deep. To talk about kind of the collective and letting our dollars speak, that's a whole other conversation we can have about the power of black dollars. And while we're not a monolithic community, certainly there are a lot of interests that we have that mm-hmm. could benefit from restraining. I think about some of the things that Martin Luther King said and others. Never will forget one of his speeches, and I think he was in Memphis and talked about there were certain companies that he explicitly named, like Coca-Cola and certain groups that were not supportive of the black plight even then. See, I think it was Seal Test Milk was another one he mentioned. But there's power in economic statements. And so I agree with you that is what would be better, but unfortunately we're not there. Is that people, so it's one thing to say that we would much rather be hired because it's the right thing to do. Unfortunately, what we've learned over time is that people have been unwilling to do the right thing. And that's why when going back to, I think, the brilliance in the way Baldwin articulated this, is that they're innocent of it. They don't know, they don't want to know that this is what they're doing and the impact it has on a group of people. They look past it. And no matter what you show in the way of facts and figures and numbers, that they're innocent of it. So I think it's interesting. So there's another place that I'd love to know what you think about this, that he goes on. And again, I think we're going to have to, you have to come back so we can talk about Down at the Cross, because we've already gone close to an hour just talking about the first in the letter to his nephew. But I have another place that I'd love to know what you think, because here again, he brings up love. But this time directed towards the them, and the them in this place are the countrymen, the whites that he's been referring to in this whole letter. But he says, you must accept them and accept them with love. For these innocent people have no other hope. And so in the margins, again, I wrote here, empathy, ? Love, ? Sarcasm, ? I don't know. Like, I'm really stuck. What do you think he's saying? You must accept them with love. For these innocent people have no other hope.
What do you think? You said you think he's what?
I don't know. I mean, I'm just struggling. It's like I read him to be very sincere all throughout, but my sarcasm is not one of half-witted sarcasm. Not one of being funny, but one of, if you don't show them love despite what they do to you, it's like they're going to be lost and broken forever. And so, you know, there's some that would say that this is kind of like let them beat you, let them misuse you and still love them. But I just don't know. I don't know. I was like, is he throwing empathy here for them? I really don't know.
I don't think it's sarcasm. I think it is more empathy. It's like, what else are you going to do but love if you meet them with the same type of hate that only taints what you have going for yourself. You can't buy into what they expect you to be. You know, it's like when you're confronting somebody who's upset, you don't raise your voice or their emotions. You're more calm. You know, that calms them. So maybe that's what he's trying to get at, is it's hard. Like, black people are always, we always have to be the bigger person, basically. Yeah. And that's emotionally taxing, but what is there but love, you know? I don't think it's going to come from bloodshed or violence. I think it's going to come from a deep evolution of radical love. I think it was Angela Davis that talked about radical love as a way to really progress as a society. If we have this love for each other and respect for each other, would racism really exist? You know?
Yeah. And there to that, that's a great segue to this next piece. In terms of what I loved about his, so he's painting a picture and then he's matching it with, and here's who you have to be. Here's how you have to, in that, like in the case he said, accept, but he, and before the place where he talked about accepting with love, he said, please try to remember that what they believe as well as what they do and cause you to endure does not testify to your inferiority, but to their inhumanity and fear. And I remember growing up, my grandmother used to always say to me that everything that was happening, and, you know, I, you know, just even in my lifetime in Alabama, I've seen, you know, Klan rallies and cross burnings and things like that. But the things that you had to see and endure and made sense out of, but she always would say, it's because they are afraid. They are afraid. Like, are you
afraid
kidding?
Of what?
Kind of, it's been passed down. If you think about it this way, we have seen people who have gone to schools with textbooks that were 20 years old. You know, I was recently visiting a school in rural Alabama last year. Well, actually, it's been more than last year, but it was before COVID. I think it was in the fall of 2019. I went to a rural school in Alabama, and I saw the kids were, their 11th grade American history textbook was one that had George W. Bush had just been elected president, and they were using this last year. That was their American history textbooks. And so what I was going to say is they have seen people who have gone to schools with inferior equipment, with outdated textbooks, go on to be the CEOs of companies, go on to be in, you know, some of the finest schools. I mean, let's take James Baldwin himself, that at Oxford University, one of the most highly regarded institutions of higher learning in the world, James Baldwin, someone who graduated from a high school in New York City, Harlem, went to debate with, that was his kind of world credential, not to mention his, again, of his world experience, but he went there to debate a gentleman who had graduated from Yale and been exposed to travel all over the world. And James Baldwin thrashed him. And so think about it. If they fear, and there are a lot of people that fear that ability, that natural ability, give a black man or a black woman an opportunity, look what happens. Look what they can do with a little of nothing. You think about...
But they failed.
Go ahead.
They fail to consider where they can evolve had they allowed Black people into public spaces? Have they allowed they failed to consider our collective humanity of growing with each other, learning from each other, and bettering each other. We don't have to be so divisive and segregated. I don't think there's really anything to fear, except for maybe a little bit of loss of power, but you gain knowledge.
Sure. But that's your perspective. But I think he also wraps it up well towards the end of the letter to his nephew, where he says, in this case, the danger in the minds of most white Americans is the loss of their identity. And that's what we found with the recent insurgents on the Capitol, was that there is a fear also of the loss of that identity, which is superiority. That's a part of the identity.
But if your identity is rooted in somebody else's oppression, it's not an identity.
It's flawed. I think that's what you struggle with, too. It's flawed. Doesn't make any sense. But it's what is. So, well, folks, we are at the end of our hour. Aaron, I really appreciate you coming on and having this conversation. Just as I predicted, we are at the end of the hour, and we only got through what is, I think, about 7 or 8 pages. So we could go on and on for a long time, and we didn't even get to the end of that. So I'm going to say, I don't know when, we'll look at our schedules and we'll figure out. Let's come back and investigate down at the cross and talk about that a little bit, because I think there are some other really kind of deep reflections that Mr. Baldwin communicated. So I just want to remind you all that are listening that about tomorrow night, the title of the show is Time Capsule Circa 1960. Anything changed? With William Spivey is my special guest. So please be sure and listen in. And then Wednesday, we're going to talk about why the conversation Black men have with their boys is necessary. And to end the week on Thursday, Black mothers, Black daughters, and American society. So again, thank you, Aaron, for being on. And for those of you who listen in on a regular basis, thank you. Thank you for your first-time listeners. Until tomorrow night, go well, stay well.